From the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, I'm Robert Caceres, and this is The Reframe. Just a quick note before we begin. This episode was actually recorded a couple months ago, so the conversation I had with Mike took place just shortly before the outbreak of the coronavirus. My guest today is Mr. Mike Shook. Mike has spent his entire counseling career working in China, where he specializes in working with expats living in Beijing. Mike is also the host of the wildly popular and informative podcast, The Thoughtful Counselor. Over the past couple years, Mike has interviewed some truly legendary figures of the profession. And so I couldn't help but ask, have those conversations helped you personally to become a better counselor? And I have to admit, I was a little surprised by his answer.
There's a big difference between knowledge acquisition and skills acquisition. You know, just because people can talk about counseling, including myself, doesn't mean I'm actually good at counseling. So one of the challenges and things I've learned is trying to figure out how to move a conversation on the podcast into my work. Without it just kind of sitting up in the clouds as a cool idea, how is it that you move these ideas into practice and let them become real life in a sense? And it's kind of actually like maybe a case against podcasts. Just because we listen to 5 podcasts about counseling doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be better counselors.
Welcome to The Reframe. Over the next hour, you'll hear Mike discuss what it's like to live and work in China, highlight the challenging and sometimes humbling nature of working with international clients, and describe his approaches to receiving and implementing corrective feedback.
One example was working with a young woman from New Zealand, and I started our first session the way I was trained to do it, and just kind of start talking about what's bringing you here today, etc., etc., and we got to the end of the session, and I solicited feedback, and she was really good about saying, you know, where I'm from, we don't just jump in and start talking about this stuff. It's helpful to have a sense of place. Like, where are you coming from? That's like one example of me being corrected by clients, but it literally happens almost every day.
Mike began our conversation by discussing how his personal experiences with counseling inspired him to leave the corporate world to pursue a career in mental health.
My path to counseling started with some good counseling. I guess when I was younger meaning like an adolescent, I had counseling once or twice, but it never really resonated with me or connected with me. But when I moved abroad, the first job and the job that I had primarily before I became a counselor was working with children with medical needs. And there was quite a bit of death. At the time, I think it was about 50% of the kids that were admitted into care of this organization would end up dying. And after a few years of working with kids closely, sick children, and then also kids who had died. I just found myself really needing somebody to talk to, and through a handful of friends, I got connected with a wonderful psychologist and loved the process. And in the process of counseling, not only was it profoundly formative for me individually, just as a person, but I found that I really looked forward to the conversations a lot more than my work itself. Not working with the kids, but more just I was in operational management, and the more that I spoke with my counselor and talked to other people about counseling, I began to realize that I didn't like organizational management, and I wasn't even particularly good at it. And I thought I would really love to move into this thing called counseling, and so that's really how that path, how I found my way into this path. And I was already here. I was living in central China at the time. And so I wanted to continue working with the organization I was working with, but move formally into counseling. And I got to start graduate school online at that point.
Yeah, not many people get to hear counselors talk about what their experiences were like in counseling. And I wonder if you could just talk more about some of the specific things that you enjoyed about it, maybe qualities of your psychologist that you thought like, oh, you know, I feel like I could be that, or wow, like that way of being is transformative.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess one thing to note is that I didn't know the difference between a psychologist, a counselor, a clinical social worker, or a marriage and family therapist. It was all just this kind of big lump of people who did the same thing, which in a lot of ways, it still feels like that. But this man, he was an older man, so I think kind of tended to have, at least for me at the time, had at least a semblance of wisdom. Whether or not, you know, he was actually wise is a different story. But as I got to know him more, he did, you know, was actually quite a wise man. But yeah, I think I, at the time, I was really isolated. And in the very beginning, just having somebody to talk to that was focused on trying to help me sort through my thoughts, just in the very beginning, that seemed to be enough. Yeah, I've thought about this a lot looking back, because as I started my career in counseling, I really wanted to exemplify for others what Vance, this counselor, had exemplified for me. And I think, you know, there was some interesting techniques looking back. Now I can kind of pinpoint maybe what he was doing. But more than anything, the listening and compassion that he brought to our conversations, I think, was transformative in itself. You know, and just that alone, I think, is so powerful to be seen in a relationship, even though it is kind of one-sided, but nonetheless, to be seen in a way that you might not be seen otherwise, I think, really moved me. And has compelled me to want to be able to do that with the people I work with as well.
Your story is very compelling, and I feel like it tracks with an experience that I hear many students coming to counseling as like a second or third profession, kind of articulating, and yet feeling uncertain or almost like they've fallen behind in their career. I would be curious to hear you talk about how, even though you didn't come to counseling as a first career, you came kind of with a conviction of this is a powerful and transformative professional capacity. And you took the initiative to switch careers, to go back to school, to do it online in another country. Would you speak about what that was like for you to say, like, you know, I'm all in on this, and kind of how having some of that life and professional experience helps you to be maybe a better student or a more grounded counselor?
Yeah, that's a good question. I appreciate that piece about being a better student, because I think that having started my graduate work later in life, it had freed up my mind in a lot of different ways. And I guess I'm reluctant to say I had developed that much, but my imagination and philosophical capacity was a lot larger. So it made my ability to engage ideas critically in my studies, it made that capacity, it just was bigger and more robust. So I think I was able to take more out of the program than I would have otherwise. Moving careers, I had jumped careers that I was kind of in the financial sector and then nonprofits work and then moved into counseling. And for me, it was as if I had missed my career in the first place. It felt more like that. I know others had successful careers and then shifted, where when I began to turn my gaze to counseling, it was as if I had finally found the thing I was supposed to have been doing all along. And, you know, and even a lot of my superiors would say I was really good at working with people, but I wasn't particularly good at organizational management. So, you know, that part of me was always present in my work, but it wasn't always what my work was asking me to do. And so as I moved into counseling, my work, what my work is asking me to do and who I am kind of began to come together in a way that hadn't otherwise prior to that.
So you decide to begin an online program in another country. I'm just fascinated, like, what that experience was like. How did you find a program? How did you kind of navigate that and balance your life living in another country in another time zone?
Oh man, yeah. I would still love to go back to do a master's in person someday. Not that I would need two master's degrees in clinical mental health counseling, but I do feel like I just long for that face-to-face connection. But I found myself in a particular place at a particular time, and it seemed quite clear to me that this was a move that I should make. And so, yeah, I guess it was I mean, depending on where you sit philosophically or theologically, it felt very divinely ordained for me that the pieces fell together in a way that just made sense. You know, there was a program, Palo Alto University, which is where I graduated from, had just started a cohort that was doing a cohort in Beijing and Shanghai. And I think that it was just the year or two before that had started a small group of both Chinese and international students. And I was lucky enough to get connected to it and get in the second or third year. I forget how many years were before me. And so it was just a really sweet possibility that opened up that didn't, you know, otherwise I'm not sure I would have known what to do or how to find a program or really where to start. So that kind of fell on my lap in a sense. And yeah, it's so many of the things that I've done now and some of the most wonderful people I know in the counseling profession are all intertwined with my time at Palo Alto. The time zone, on the other hand, and the great firewall of China is what the meaning the internet restrictions. Those two things almost killed me trying to get stuff done. They still almost kill me trying to keep a podcast alive because the time zone alone makes everything have to be done late at night or early in the morning. And then the firewall makes, you know, if we go on, we're assigned a video on like psychotherapy.net, it could take us 3 hours to watch a 1 hour video. So we, you know, whatever, you might assign something on acceptance and commitment therapy. And so we'd hop on there and watch Stephen Hayes do a session, but it would take us 3 hours to watch a single session. And, you know, there's things like that that I don't miss by any means. I'm happy that that stuff is over, but, you know, luckily there was more than one of, you know, it wasn't just me. There was, I think 12 or 15 students in my cohort. And so we could lament together the fact that we were wasting so much time due to the internet, but also share ideas and workarounds. And there was a deep sense of camaraderie with our cohort because of some of the more difficult parts of trying to complete a master's degree in China from a university in California.
Well, you remarked on kind of just those distinctly different aspects of what it's like to be in China, whether it's technological limitations or just various cultural issues or just the simple reality and logistics of being in a different time zone. I talked to a lot of students who were interested in working abroad, and I've had students from China or students who would like to go and eventually work in China. And it's a very underdeveloped, emerging profession that's not as established as it is in the United States. Could you speak to kind of what that process was like, kind of figuring out what it was going to be like for you in your capacity as a counselor in China that might be dramatically different than what someone would imagine living here in America?
Yeah, some of the more difficult pieces from the get-go were really kind of practical things like a practicum site. You know, in the U.S., it seems like, I don't actually know if this is true, but it just seems like they're everywhere. Like you might be able to find a place to do, you know, 100 places in your city to do practicum, where we were just bending over backwards to try to find places that could meet the requirements, and we could work with populations that we felt suitable to work with. And so that's one of the things I think that people wouldn't necessarily think about on the front end, especially starting your degree, thinking of how you're going to set up practicum like that. But yeah, it's been a really fascinating and humbling, that's probably more than anything, a humbling process. Because there's really two worlds in a sense. There's mental health services for cross-cultural workers, so foreign passport holders living in China, so people from the U.S., Africa, Europe, etc. And then there's obviously Chinese folks seeking mental health services. And so they're two quite distinct groups, even though there's interconnectedness between the professions or the professionals. It's not one tight-knit group, I guess you might say. And so, and rightly so, in some sense, that to be culturally competent, like for me, I felt quite limited to work particularly with international workers, basically, meaning people who are international folks living and working abroad, because that's a context in general that I can understand. I feel like culturally we're able to, I'd be reluctant to take this too far, but that I feel like we're able to connect in a way that I can enter their world at least enough to understand where they're coming from. Where with some of my Chinese colleagues, I'd prefer to refer a local Chinese person to a Chinese colleague just because of the cultural dynamics that I wouldn't be able to, I don't think I'd be able to ethically do it well and really speak into somebody's life without having carried the weight of the culture with me over time. And different people feel different about that particular issue, but anyway, I'm sorry. I think I'm meandering it quite a bit on your question.
Oh, no, not at all. But you bring up that sense of ethics. And my understanding, my limited understanding of China is because it's not a well-established or clearly defined profession. There isn't a standardized license. There isn't like a set ethical code. That's almost like a set of ethics that you've imposed on yourself in light of maybe your professional identity and training. To what guides maybe your practice of counseling as a profession in light of the lack of standardization in your country?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, just to backtrack a little bit, one thing I think that also that has been very humbling and really challenging in a good way for me is learning from Chinese colleagues that Western conceptual frameworks of illness are quite depraved when you pull them into Eastern contexts. You know, there's a lot of people, critical psychiatry has been saying things like this for decades. Ethan Waters has written a really lovely book called Crazy Like Us that draws attention to this. But that some folks here, Chinese folks, don't need mental health counseling. They might need acupuncture or Chinese medicine, because the way that illness manifests is very different than it does for us in the West. And that's been really, at first I kind of pushed back against it, but now I really embrace it. And it's expanded my understanding of what, a healing profession is, and that the distinctions between different healing professions probably aren't as rigid. They're a little bit more porous than I originally understood them to be. As for my work, I think, and to kind of spit off the stock answer for a counselor is I tend to stick with you know, at least as close as I can to the ACA code of ethics, the MBCC's code of ethics, and I don't mind straying from those when I see fit, but it has to be in consultation, and I have to be able to back that up with good reasoning. But, you know, there's certain things I think that present themselves, certain issues that present themselves in a context like this, where I live in a city with 22 million people, but the community in which I'm known as a counselor is a lot smaller than that. And so it's almost like working in a small, super rural town, but a small town where I'll come across people I work with all the time. And so that's been something I hadn't anticipated, and I've had to consult with other people who have been here longer and understand, you know, try to get to know how it is that they approach these issues and begin developing an ethic that's appropriate for my context, as opposed to just one that sounds good on paper.
I mean, clearly it's been a process and an evolution. I'd be curious to hear about kind of what maybe some of those initial missteps, you know, areas of confusion were, and how you've grown and developed your understanding and that sense of competency within the scope of what you feel comfortable doing, you know, presently.
Yeah, well, the missteps have never ended. So, you know, I'm constantly misstepping. but for me, I think that's okay. It's part of the learning process and growing and becoming a more, it's not to sound silly, but thoughtful and committed professional or, you know, counselor. I don't even consider myself a professional as much as I would just a counselor. But yeah, there's a lot of things like that. Just learning what to do when you run into somebody at a restaurant more than once, or you run into multiple clients at a restaurant at the same time, you know, things like that that must happen other places, but it just, you know, kind of I'll fumble around with it and then try to figure out what to do and then make a mistake and then consult in supervision, get some clarity, come back and regroup and try to do it better the next time. I think probably the more challenging pieces for me are that while all of my clients are international, they're from all over the world. So that sounds kind of silly, but they're international in the Beijing community. So there's a bit of that's a community in itself. But then within that community, there's people from literally all over the world. So on a given day, I might have a client from the United States and then from Lithuania and then from Uganda and then, you know, who knows, Australia, whatever. And that just because we're all international passport holders doesn't mean I have any idea about their life or context. And so it's taken a lot of work to learn how to be culturally humble enough to ask questions that help situate, how would I put this? That helped me enter somebody else's world. We have a shared world in a sense, in a lot of ways. So we might have shared frustrations or shared experiences because of living in Beijing, but there's quite a bit that we don't share, and I can't make assumptions based on that. And so a lot of my fumbling around and missteps have been trying to learn how to do that well, and be culturally humble enough to be wrong in conversations and be corrected, and then let that shape how I proceed with my work.
Are there certain ways that you approach this session dispositionally that convey that curiosity and that humility that you feel like have allowed you to gracefully work through those missteps and allow the clients to kind of forgive you or patiently bear with you as you maybe step in it from time to time?
Yeah, well, you should ask my clients whether or not it's graceful, because I don't think it is, depending on how much sleep I got the night before. Early on in my training, I came across the work of Barry Duncan, Scott Miller, Bruce Wampold, and Michael Lambert, all about common factors and outcome measures and feedback. And I began to get really interested in this because it kind of was like it transcended theory, specific theories, and it was focusing on collecting systematic outcome data, but then also systematic feedback in conversations from clients, and then working to take that feedback and reapply it in the conversation the next time you speak. And I have so many great examples of clients giving me concrete feedback of where I went wrong. And then the challenge was for me to first, one, take that and not take it personal. And then two, to find ways to honor the feedback and work it into a conversation. And you know, like one example was working with a young woman from New Zealand. And I started our first session the way I was trained to do it, and just kind of start talking about what's bringing you here today, you know, what's et cetera, et cetera. And we got to the end of the session and I solicited feedback. I said, how did this go? You know, what do you think went well? What didn't go well? And And she was really good about saying, you know, where I'm from, we don't just jump in and start talking about this stuff. It's helpful to have a sense of place. Like, where are you coming from? It's escaping me now, but there was a formal process that she turned me on to, that she taught me, basically. And so the next time we met, we did this process together of me saying, like, where I grew up, what rivers I was close to, what mountains were nearby. And she did the same thing, and that kind of reshaped the way we engaged in our relationship. And so things like that, just constantly. That's like one example of me being corrected by clients, but it literally happens almost every day. And the challenge isn't so much being offended that I got something wrong, but taking what my clients are telling me and then incorporating it into the way that I'm engaging in the conversation.
Yeah, that was my thought exactly, is if this is something that's a near constant experience that you can almost get up, you know, look forward to your day, anticipate that there's going to be some corrective feedback. How are you able to integrate that into your future work in a way that feels sustainable or not just overly burdensome? That seems like a very daunting task. And I say that as someone who the bulk of my work is training aspiring counselors, and I have like a very small private practice. So I'm not seeing the number of clients that you are to, you know, necessitate me getting as much maybe corrective feedback. So it's probably a different experience for me just by the ratio of like hours per week I do counseling versus yours.
Well, I guess you have to, how would I put it? It's kind of a philosophy of approaching how we're going to approach our work. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to put this, and a lot of people will say it different ways, but we can either think that we're really good at what we do, or we can realize that we're probably not as good as we think we are, and deliberately engage in practices that help us become better at what we do. And the point is never getting every session right, which would be, I think, is impossible. You know, the irony, I think, in the 20th century, everybody would talk about different psychologists and psychiatrists as the best, the best, most well-renowned counselor, you know, person, but nobody asked the clients. So it's ironic that psychologists are telling psychologists that they're really good at what they do, or counselors are telling counselors that they're really good at what they do, but not a lot of people are asking clients if their counselors are good at what they do. So there's a gap, I think, in talking about whether or not we're good at this stuff and actually listening to the people that are receiving our services and seeing what they think. I don't know, I find that profoundly moving because, well, one, it takes the pressure off me getting it right every time. Two, it puts the ball in the client's court that, you know, and make sure that they are equally contributing to the work by helping understand what's going to be most effective in a given conversation. And I think if all of my sessions in a day I got bad feedback, I'd feel kind of like trash, you know. But so I think it's helpful to have a balance of people that you know, at least half seem to think things are going well. I'm surprised. So, like, for example, I've been collecting systematic outcome data on my work for 3 years or something like that, and I just crunched the numbers, and I'm right smack dab in the middle. I am really good at what I do, and I'm about as good as half the people doing the work. I'd love to say I'm better than that. I'd love to say I'm like in the top 90%, you know, or top, you know, whatever, just the top tier. But I can't get there if I don't know kind of where my blind spots are, or where I might need to put some focus and some more work. And the people I work with have given me that gift by kind of helping me become a better counselor. I know that might sound a little bit ethically suspect. So it's not like I'm, you know, putting the ball in their court to tell me what to do. But I am taking seriously their voice and their knowledge of what's happening and their knowledge of their life and helping me understand how I could shift the way that I'm working to meet their specific need.
Well, I don't think that sounds suspect at all. I think it just sounds responsive. That, like, from a philosophical or theoretical perspective, that you don't think of yourself as the expert. And so, like, an important part of that process is receiving that feedback. And I guess a couple things come to mind for me. Recently, I heard someone, I can't remember who it was, kind of saying, like, you know, they give a lot of presentations and they, you know, ask the audience, raise your hand if you feel like you're an above average counselor. And everyone raises their hand. And it's like, well, then where are the average or below average people? Like, there's somebody or many of you here who are just average counselors. And then I also think, too, about, you know, you said we're not as good as maybe we think we are, or we're not that good all the time. And I think about my own personal experience and how there were a lot of times that I felt like, oh, a session was just okay, or maybe it fell flat, or I end every session by inviting feedback, and maybe the client didn't have much to say or didn't know how to say it, and so I didn't really receive any actionable feedback. And then later over the course of our work, some of the things that have resonated with clients the most, or kind of those touchdowns that maybe I thought were just throwaway moments of something I said as reflecting or perhaps offering insight, they held, you know, as transformative, profound, very meaningful experiences. And had they not told me that later, I would have been left with the feeling of like, oh, you know, that was just another maybe okay session. And so I guess I say that for the audience as well. It's like, we're probably never as good as we might think we are. And, you know, because this is the reframe, I'd say maybe we're never as bad as we might think we are in a given session or a given day. That it might be, like you said, smack dab in the middle, is like over time it is going to level out, whether it's collectively with all of our clients or maybe just with a specific client.
Yeah, it's such a good point. I've had the same experience where I'll be nearing the end of a session and just be thinking, wow, this was horrible. I talked too much. I meandered, you know, I misstepped, and then we'll get to the end and I'll say, you know, it seems like maybe I talked too much, but I'm curious at how you experienced our time together. And they'll say something like, no, this was extremely helpful. This is one of our best conversations yet. And I'll just be kind of blown away, you know. And then ironically, the flip side will happen too, where I'll be in a session and I feel like I'm firing on all cylinders and just, you know, flying in the clouds. And like, man, I wish I videotaped this. I wish this would be the one session everybody could see. And then I'll ask the person how it went, and they'll be like, "Nah, you know, it was okay, but it didn't. It's, you know, nothing really connected." And that's humbling too. You know, it is kind of balancing out in a sense that I like how you said it. We're probably never as good as we think we are, but we're never as bad as we think we are either. And I like that phrase.
I would want to ask you, for those out there who are considering working abroad, maybe even specifically in China, what would your advice be for individuals who are considering, maybe they study in the United States or they study in Europe and they're looking to move to a different continent with a completely different culture? Just generally speaking, what might be some good resources or good considerations for them to process as they take that leap?
Yeah, I think I'd go two directions. One professionally would be to try to, well, if you're already solidified your kind of professional identity in a particular theory, find where that theory, where the boundaries have been expanded to be culturally responsive. Some theories are more just from the get-go more culturally responsive than others, but I think all of the theories have folks who are proponents of the theory who are writing in a way that's expansive of the theory and kind of pushing the boundaries in a way that can include cultural competence. So professionally, I'd suggest, you know, either expanding your theory base to include culturally competent or culturally responsive practices, or consider doing some studies in some theories that are kind of specifically culturally open, I guess you could say. Like, narrative therapy for me has been quite helpful in that sense, because it's very focused on stories and then also deconstructing stories. And there's a bit of an openness, and it's relationally oriented. So cultures that aren't individualistic, it can tend to fit quite well. But I don't think that it's necessarily the only theory or even the best that would be usable in a different context. So that would be my first suggestion, just begin to do some reading, some professional reading. But on the flip side, there's nothing better than good novels. If you're going to move to a different country and you want to work there, get some good books, good novels, and start reading about, novels by writers from that country, and start beginning to inhabit the world that you're going to go to via the writings that have been produced there. Because novels are some of the most prophetic. It's one of the most prophetic formats, I think, that we can enter into. And if you begin letting that shape your imagination, you might be surprised at how much, when you hit the ground, you'll feel a little bit more. I mean, maybe not greatly, but at least a little bit more competent. Yeah, hopefully that helps.
Both of those resonate deeply with kind of my personality and my style and my worldview. And I love that you emphasized, first and foremost, think about it from a professional and theoretical standpoint, that wherever you go, you'll have a competency that will, at face value, set itself up to be effective in entering into that culture and engaging those clients. And then also, just from an imagination standpoint and shaping kind of your disposition and your cultural understanding and your excitement and openness to all of that. But then I think about how I have to stretch myself beyond my natural inclinations, which are exactly those. And I think about those who are like A-type planners. You said going back, like, organization was not like your preference or your strong suit. What about for those out there who are like, but what about the concrete things? Like, what do I have to do to plan and logistically make this happen? Where are those logistical details? What would you say to those people?
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah. Well, the first place to start practically would be to begin understanding what the licensure or certification processes are, because licensing in the U.S. and certification elsewhere are not always the same thing. And just because you have a U.S. license doesn't mean anybody's going to honor that. So wherever you want to end up, that's one very important thing to begin considering right at the outset, is trying to understand what types of certifications are necessary to practice in that country, in the way that you're wanting to practice. And I wish there was like a website you could go to that would make all that clear, but it's insanely complicated, and it just depends on where you're going to go. I think that's the first place to start. Then, like a lot of people will say, knowing the population you want to work with is key, because then that can narrow down the way in which you might search for places to providers that you might want to work with. So like in my context, if you wanted to move to Beijing and work with international folks, you would probably try to apply at one of the international hospitals or clinics that provides mental health services. So that's a step that, kind of a step further of getting to know the place, and what kind of work you'd want to be doing in that place. So I think those, if I was getting my start, those would be the two places I would immediately begin, making sure that certification would be, or licensing would be, appropriate and doable. And then also exploring exactly what type of context I want to work in whatever country I would want to move to.
That's all incredibly helpful. I'd love to ask, with our time remaining, about the podcast that you host and have hosted for some time. I know when I look at the iTunes rankings, y'all are always, up there in the top 25, top 50 of like social sciences podcasts. You're one of kind of like the forerunners. I know on your website it says like hundreds of thousands of downloads. What was the motivation or the impetus for you starting The Thoughtful Counselor?
Yeah. It's so silly to think about it now, because I mean, you have a microphone and you have a podcast and you know what it takes, which is surprisingly little to set up a microphone and email some people to get to see if they want to talk to you. So, you know, like we've grown because my thought is because of longevity more than anything. We've just been doing it for a while and there's a lot of episodes. So I don't think we can claim any kind of superiority or, you know, as if we're the first or the best or whatever. I don't think anybody in our project would care to make those claims, but we're grateful to have been able to continue doing it for as long as we have, selfishly, because we get to talk to people who otherwise wouldn't talk to us. So that's really the origins of the podcast, were that I was living in Beijing and I had just graduated with my degree, and the spaces where I could talk to people about counseling had dried up because I wasn't in class anymore. And the amount of people in the city, the amount of mental health, English speaking mental health professionals, was, you know, maybe 40 people, all quite busy, and rarely would people sit and hang out and just talk about theory or ethics or, you know, whatever. So I wanted to talk to people about counseling and learn more, continue to engage my mind as I was growing in my practice. And that's more or less how it started. And I learned very quickly that I couldn't do it by myself, because I'm good at starting things, but I'm horrible about keeping them going. And so it's quickly evolved into a team of folks with different specialties and from different backgrounds, and focuses, and et cetera. And all of us just trying to contribute conversation to the greater good and people interested in ideas around counseling.
So you started as, in a sense, kind of promoting your own professional development, nurturing your curiosity, and almost like a form of practice support for yourself that maybe could be beneficial for others. You've had a chance to talk to some heavy hitters, and you've talked to many very experienced, very competent, accomplished people. What are some of your major takeaways from those conversations and experiences that you've had producing a podcast for the number of years that you have?
I've learned a lot. There's an interesting thing. I've been really trying to understand this more recently. But there's a big difference between knowledge acquisition and skills acquisition. Just because people can talk about counseling, including myself, you know, doesn't mean I'm actually good at counseling. And so that's something I've learned through the podcast. Not that anybody I've spoken with are bad counselors, because I haven't actually seen them do their work. But I have learned just over the process of doing it that to be able to speak competently about a profession doesn't mean you can practice it competently. And that's been really humbling and challenging for me, because I like to talk, you know, and I can read articles and regurgitate ideas. So one of the challenges and things I've learned is trying to figure out how to move a conversation on the podcast into my work, without it just kind of sitting up in the clouds as a cool idea. How is it that you move these ideas into practice and let them become real life, in a sense? And I think I've, you know, learned ideas of how to do that through the people I've spoken with over time. So that's kind of funny, because it's not profound in the sense that, like, it's profoundly simple, and it's kind of actually like maybe a case against podcasts, because we listen to 5 podcasts about counseling doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be better counselors. And I think that's something that's really important, that's really caught my attention since doing this. But I have also found, and somebody else asked me this question recently, and I never realized how truly diverse the counseling profession is until I started the podcast. And I've spoken to so many people who are professionally counselors. So we've spoken to other folks as well, psychologists, social workers, but the vast majority of the people we have on our podcast are counselors and counselor educators. And I'm just amazed by the diversity of folks who are part of the counseling profession, including diversity of ideas, conflicting ideas. And I really appreciate that. It's actually made me love the profession more to know that there'll be people who write one paper about an ethical idea and then another person who thinks it's total crap. And they'll write a paper about why the other paper was wrong. And, you know, I realize that that can get quite petty, and academia has its own problems if you're just publishing for the ivory tower. But I do think that there's a sweetness and that helps move a profession along when you have a diversity of voices. And as I've learned, as I've noticed that more and more, I've tried to do my best to showcase that in conversations on the podcast, because it's really helped me, you know, and I think, you know, others might not feel this way, but depending on the day, I feel, you know, like I oscillate between what I think is a good idea and a bad idea, and what's a good theory and a bad theory.
So you said that listening to, you know, five or a bunch of counseling podcasts may not make you a better counselor if you're not able to kind of take that from a nice idea and assimilate it into your practice. But at the same time, it seems like as a podcaster, that experience may have helped you to be a better counselor, or I guess for lack of a better description, a more thoughtful counselor. Could you just reflect on that process?
Yeah, I'm always go to that word thoughtful, and not because that's the name of the podcast, but it's just a convenient word. And then it's kind of embarrassing because it sounds funny to say that. But I don't know. You know, I can't honestly say whether or not doing the podcast has made me a better counselor in practice, but it has made me more passionate about counseling. And my hope would be that that passion translates to me being a better counselor, being more present with the people I work with, and being more relationally engaged when I'm sitting across from someone. But again, I think given the opportunity, you could ask the people I work with and see what they think, because they're the ones who would be able to tell you whether or not it's actually made me any better at what I do.
Yeah, I mean, of course, all of this is anecdotal and limited to our experience, but I mean, how awesome and valuable is it to feel like you're encouraged and inspired and enthusiastic about what you do by hearing kind of the triumphs and the struggles of other professionals out there trying to do the same work, and just to have that community of practice support and of encouragement of kind of like you're not in this alone, and to hear that diversity of ideas and to feel like you're participating in facilitating the, you know, disseminating of those diverse ideas, to me, like that's all like a net positive. And I wonder if that just like edges off burnout as well.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the way that you put that, I forgot the wording you used, but something like a community of practice, that is definitely the personal benefit of the podcast for me. And hopefully, I'd imagine for people who listen, is that you feel connected to other professionals and you're hearing stories about our work and the good, the bad, and the ugly. For me, for sure, it helps prevent or at least put a dent in burnout, because I'm always in conversation with other folks who are doing really interesting and exciting things, and also come up against difficulties and challenges just like myself. So, you know, given like all the money and time in the world, I would love to have like a, I don't know what you would call it, but you know, where people could, listeners could gather together and actually discuss more, so that there was more engagement in the way that you were alluding to. But you know, without all the riches and time, that's probably going to have to be put on the back burner.
So, what would you say out there to someone who's thinking about starting their own podcast? You said, you know, it could be as simple as you turn on a microphone and you shoot off some emails, or it could be as complicated and, like, you know, technical and time consuming to produce as someone might want to make it. For everyone in between that who wants to just, like, you know, shoot them off or have a really polished podcast, what would you say to those out there who are either experienced professionals, academics, students even? You know, would you encourage someone to start a podcast if there's an interest there?
My suggestion would be to only start something like a podcast if you want to do it for the love of doing it. Don't get wrapped up in it growing or being concerned about people knowing about you doing it. If you're starting it for the love of doing it, then there, you can't go wrong, because if you get to talk to people that you're interested in, then you've already won. You know, it's already a success. I remember I think probably within the first 2 months of the podcast, I got to interview Craig Cashwell, and I had read a bunch of his work because he's kind of this towering figure in the integration of spirituality and counseling. And I could have stopped doing the podcast right after that and just been like, all right, it was worth it. So I think if people, in a broad sense, if you want to start it just for the love of the conversation, then you can't go wrong. I think if you're wanting to start it to like promote your private practice or to make a name for yourself, then you might want to slow down and consider the costs a little bit more, because it does take a lot of work. And if you're expecting an actual payoff from it, then you might want to consider other things that would be more direct payoffs. I think just if you love conversation and you want to get something going, it is surprisingly easy. And there's, like you're saying, you could go the whole spectrum, just record it and slap it in a podcast or full production. And that's also important to know what kind of show you want to make. The more we've been around and the more I've listened to really well produced podcasts, the more I am embarrassed by the low production quality of what I put out. Not so much the audio quality, but just I listened to something like On Being by Krista Tippett, and the flow of the music and the way that they cut interviews and just the beauty, the finished product in itself is just beautiful. And that's just something, that's a different level that I think, if there's a counselor out there that wants to take it to that level, let me know, because we'll just give you our podcast to make it beautiful.
I love what you said, like, if you're going to do it for the right reasons and it's something that you feel like can be sustainable over time, maybe some of those immediate desires like notoriety or a big listenership may not be there, but that's not to say that they won't come with time.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, it's fun. You know, I think, I'm not sure how you think about the reframe, but for me, the thoughtful counselor has always been like, I'd love to sit and talk with these people at a conference, and I'd love to have other people sit and listen, or that we could all just sit and talk to these people. Basically, letting people listen in on our curiosity, and that's kind of the format, more or less. There's nothing particularly profound or well produced about it, but I think that's maybe what in some sense makes it enjoyable, is because it really is like showing up at a conference and asking somebody to have a cup of coffee with you and pick their brain for an hour. And there's something kind of magical about that simplicity.
Oh, I'm with you 100%. Oftentimes in preparation for a guest, I'll ask my students, you're studying out of this person's textbook right now. What would you want to ask them personally? Or just think about like ways in which like just everyday people who wouldn't necessarily get to bump into and have an hour-long conversation with one of these people at a conference, what would they want to know? And also too, the intimacy of it. You referenced earlier your interview with Craig Cashel. I remember listening to that the day it came out a couple of years ago as I was mowing my grass. And, so like I'm at Wake Forest and he's up the road at UNC Greensboro, very esteemed institution. He's a legendary guy. And I was just blown away by his vulnerability, by how he just kind of laid it bare. And much as you did at the beginning of this conversation, talked about his own struggles, his own experiences with counseling or with just challenging aspects of his life, and how that informed both his being as a person, but also his approaches to teaching and to counseling. And that was very striking to me. And that's one of the things that I strive for on this podcast, is at least to hopefully cultivate a dynamic in a conversation that allows someone to be a bit more honest and vulnerable. Because when a person's far removed from, say, like the work you're doing, they could go to your glossy website and see your impressive catalog of topics and guests and your team and number of downloads and just think like, I could never be that. But then like, you sit here and you share about your struggles and the things that you need to work on. And my hope is that for those listening, those ambitious goals are not seen as like a far off destination, but just like incremental steps that require, you know, self-reflection, determination, and just perseverance.
And if my wife was here, she would tell you there's definitely nothing impressive about me. So the website makes, you know, it's all a facade because it looks a lot cleaner. I mean, you see me, I look like a disaster right now. You should have saw me 2 hours ago with my three kids. You know, the website doesn't show that, or the screaming that happens before I hit record. And I just the other day, I had to cancel an interview like 5 minutes before it started because, and this is with Tony, I can never say his name right, but Tony Rusmanier, who's one of the forefront, just at the front of the field, writing about deliberate practice, because our childcare fell through and my 2-year-old was just screaming at the top of his lungs. And so there's nothing impressive or prestigious about running a podcast. You can make a website look prestigious, but you know, it doesn't make you prestigious.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for your time and for managing all the things that you need to manage to ensure that like you could even give your time and attention to this podcast. As we wrap up, I end every show by asking the guests to think about a time in their life where maybe they were going through an experience or thinking about something in a particular way that wasn't productive or wasn't helpful, and they just stepped back and thought about it in a different way. And that way of reframing that reality, that experience, just made all the difference.
Yeah, I when you sent that in the email, I was racking my brain for like a good one, you know, like a nice rich story. But I couldn't come up with anything until we were talking earlier about transitioning from one career to the next. And you know, by the time I ended my work in nonprofit operations, I felt like a total failure in that world. I had burned myself out on the work because it was intense. And yeah, I didn't leave anything, at least at the time, that's how it felt. I didn't leave anything behind that was worth taking note of. And I'd still say that to some extent, like as an organizational manager, I don't think I offered much. But when I, you know, with the terminology of reframe, I have spoken to people around me during that time and people that I worked with or that worked like underneath me. It was clear to everybody else except for me that like I wasn't, there was something being birthed in that process, which was who I am today and what I do now. And so I've often reflected back on that period of time and used to lament it, and still to some extent I do, because I feel like I let people down and I hurt people or said things I ought not to have said. But when I see kind of what that time was giving birth to, it's helped me look back on it in a different way. And so it doesn't take the sting out of it by any means, but it does kind of shift the soil in a way that helps me see that more was happening than I was aware of at the time, and probably am still not aware of half of what was being birthed those years in that intense work. Yeah, so I think that's something that's really moved me recently as I've thought about it more and more and kind of wondered why or how it is that I've become so concerned about sitting with people's stories of pain. And I look back on that time and it was probably one of the breeding grounds for that desire.
The Reframe is a production of the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join me next month on The Reframe.